to the Animation Podcast, a weekly podcast about all things animation brought to you by Filmbook. My name is Matt Brunet, but some of you may know me as Animat from my YouTube channel, Electric Dragon 505, home of web series that are all about animation, including Animation Look Back and Animat's Reviews. If this is your first time here in the Animation Podcast, the title will go and explain everything for you. This is a podcast in which I shall discuss about animation. Do you understand that? If you don't, then just rewind and just play it over again until you fully understand what I'm talking about. But specifically, it is the latest news that actually happened this week. So for starters, I'm going to be talking about finally the end of a big battle of animators versus big name studios. And then we will be looking into the final trailer of the Beauty and the Beast reboot. Then we will be reflecting upon the life of Hal Greer. Then afterwards, we will be talking about the idea of a live-action Ruby movie. And then finally, we got Matt's Pick of the Week. If you want to check out more episodes of the Animation Podcast, then all you have to do is head on down to Filmbook, that is film-book.com, by searching the Animation Podcast. You can also email us at podcast@filmbook.com with the Animation Podcast in the subject line. And so, first things first, let me tell you guys about a big battle that has been going on for probably more than 2.5 years. I would even say more than almost 3 years. And if you have been following animation news like I would, you might have heard about the wage theft lawsuit. Now, basically, just to summarize it all up, you can actually go to Cartoon Brew to find an entire article called "What is the Animation Wage Fixing Lawsuit? An Explainer for the Community." That pretty much tells you the entire information. But if I can explain it briefly here, basically what it is that a whole bunch of some of the biggest animation studios in the U.S., which would include companies like Disney, Pixar, Lucasfilms, DreamWorks, Sony, Blue Sky, Image Movers. At one point between 2004 and 2010, they all got together and they actually agreed to do something that seems a little bit scammy per se. Basically, their idea was that not only they wanted to go and lower the wages of their own employees to the point that it's pretty much like dangerously low, almost unlivably low, but also they agreed not to go after each other's employees to hire different people. Like, they're not gonna go poach like others. Like, you won't see Sony poaching at Pixar or DreamWorks poaching at Disney. That's pretty much the big agreement that they decided to do. It wasn't until on September 2014 when there was one animator, I have a sort, like I'm using my source here on Cartoon Brew, trying to find exactly who did it. Hold on a sec. Ah, there we go. It was an animator at DreamWorks Animation, I believe, Robert Nitsch, who actually discovered that when there was a bigger lawsuit going on. That was between the big electronic companies like Google, Apple, Intel, and Adobe. Like, they actually found a clue that this was also happening in the animation industry when Ed Catmull was also involved with it. So, on December 2014, Nitsch decided to go and file a lawsuit against those companies. The main ones, it started out with Disney, Pixar, Lucasfilms, and DreamWorks. And then there were other animators who decided to join in, like David Wentworth and Georgia Cano, who both of them worked at Image Movers Digital. And then the list pretty much grew of the amount of animation studios that was actually involved. Sony Pictures Imageworks, Sony Pictures Animation, Blue Sky Studios, and all those companies were suddenly added into this big list. But then came 2016. In last year, we were pretty much seeing the whole case deteriorating. And it started out with Blue Sky decided to get out of it by doing a settlement. And then suddenly Sony came in and they decided to get out of it by doing a settlement. And then after, when DreamWorks was officially owned by Universal, they decided to make a settlement and leave. And then this week, It's pretty much the big game changer. And this could be the clear sign that this lawsuit is over. The Walt Disney Company has finally decided to get out of this lawsuit by making a settlement. Disney was pretty much representing Walt Disney Animation Studios, Pixar, and Lucasfilms, and they agreed to go out in a settlement that's worth $100 million, pretty much the biggest piece of the pie from all the other studios. Not just those three, but they were also representing, Image Movers Digital, now called 2PIC MC. So pretty much now they decided to get out of it. And the total worth that the animators are pretty much going to be getting at the time, it's pretty much going to be going in a total of $170 million. So like I said, Disney is the biggest piece of pie with $100 million. And then following up, it's DreamWorks Animation, where they settle with $50 million. And then you also got Sony, which they went out with $13 million, and finally Blue Sky, like, they got the smallest piece of the pie with $6 million. So in total, it pretty much makes almost $170 million. And honestly, just by looking at it, I'm just honestly really glad for the animators just to see that there is officially a closure to this. Like I said before, this whole lawsuit was just going on for almost 3 years, and it was really crazy. Down to the point that, like, you could see Disney was not giving up for the longest time, even after when you start to see the defendants just deteriorating, when Sony bailed and when Blue Sky bailed. Like, they were sticking to their guns, and for a while, DreamWorks was also staying in, but then suddenly, we all know that last year, DreamWorks had that big, that big purchase from NBC Universal. So now, they got, like, this whole new management going on, and they decided there's no point in really staying in this lawsuit, so they paid a $50 million settlement and just move on. So it was only Disney at that point, and it seems that, you know, the case was really starting to be against them, especially when all the other defendants decided to leave. So they decided, you know, to close down the book and just officially make a settlement. Now, at this point, like, what's going to be happening now with the animators? I feel like there isn't going to be much that would change. Keep in mind, like, this whole thing was going on between 2004 and 2010. And considering that we are in 2017, I think the way that animation studios, especially in the big name animation studios, how they're running is a lot more different than how it is back then. But still, I think, like, this is more for reassurance for those animators at that time between 2004 and 2010. This is finally something that they can move on with their lives. It's something that they can finally, like, they no longer have to hold, like, some kind of grudge against the studios for doing these shady practices in order for the big heads to save a couple of bucks. Or, like, basically, they don't have to see these big companies exploiting their own employees in order to create these animated features. Like, for them, it's more like, okay, finally we can just move on with our lives. It doesn't matter anymore, like, what they have done. Like, now they could just focus on what they are currently working, and they could just move on. They know that, like, these shady practices, hopefully, are no longer continuing, and they do have justice. They do have the payment that they actually deserve to get, you know? And with that said, hopefully, you know, I think that's just all that I can ask for, is just we can all move on from this. There's no longer any shady practices. There's no longer any skeletons in the closets. They're all pretty much thrown out of that closet. It's cleaned up. So we should be all good, hopefully, at this point. Like, they have all paid their debts. They've all paid their dues. So yeah, this is the one thing that I definitely am happy to see, is that there's officially a closure to this case, you know, is it's pretty much the time when animators are finally getting the justice that they deserve. It's no longer just the big companies, like the artists and the animators, the real people behind the movies that we all love, like they're finally getting their due. And when they speak out for their voice, when they see injustice, they actually do something about it. They take action. And this is pretty much the result, is that, you know, it may require a bit of patience. It may take a lot of years in order to make. But with all that said, the end result would eventually pay off. And this is what happened right here, quite literally. So, basically, if I may go into my source here, like what's going to be happening at this point with the case, like again, going in my source, Cartoon Brew, it states a final fairness hearing has been proposed for March 9th, 2017. It will hopefully put an end to an ugly episode in animation history and serve as a reminder to animation studios that their workers need to be treated with respect and fairness. And hopefully that's going to be the big lesson, you know? It, like that's the whole thing with this whole lawsuit. It's going to be served as a big lesson. And if ever they would stupidly do this again, well, then they would have to face the consequences. But for now, like, I'm just glad that this is finally over, that we can finally go and move on from all this. It is pretty much the day when the artist won. Okay, so for our next story right here, we're going to be looking into a trailer, not for an animated feature, well, almost. It is going to be for a live-action movie that it seems like it's going to be highly anticipated. In fact, I'm sure for many people, this would be one of the most anticipated movies of the year. And I am talking, of course, about the 2017 live-action reboot of Beauty and the Beast, in which this week Disney decided to release the final trailer for this movie. And we actually do get to see some brand new clips of it. And I think at this point, with what we got with this trailer, I don't really think that, you know, what we got here is really going to change people's perspectives on how the movie is going to be. Like I said before, the most that we got with this is just we're seeing brand new clips of it. And on top of that, we actually do get a bit of a preview of the new version of the Beauty and the Beast song sung by Ariana Grande and John Legend. And what we got so far, well, honestly, once again, like with the other trailers, I just feel a little bit mixed about it. Let me just go and start off with the bad just to get that out of the way. Once again, I'm just pretty much proven here that the casting of Emma Watson as Belle here, it's nothing but an absolute mistake, and I'm pretty sure it's also a mistake for her, considering the recent news that we got is that apparently Emma Watson was just way too picky to be in La La Land. So what ended up happening is that she decided to go with Disney in order to do this. So yeah, like instead of Emma Watson being in La La Land, she's pretty much stuck with a role that she couldn't even play in the first place. And you could probably, like, I guess that could probably give an explanation why she's not at her best when she's performing in here. I mean, even like just watching the trailer, just the bits that you see Emma Watson playing as Belle, like she's not into it. Like you could tell that she's just, yeah, I'm not saying that she doesn't want to be there. It's more like she's not even trying to be Belle. She's not trying to act in order to do justice for a legendary animated feature. I mean, if you've seen interviews with Emma Watson about this movie, you could tell that she has no care whatsoever about the animated feature. I could definitely tell you that. That and also, my God, is like a lot of the CGI that I'm seeing, it's crap. A lot of it's crap. I mean, like you got the Beast himself who is just who looks absolutely laughable. And like also the objects themselves, it's just another bunch of CGI mess. And like they really are going into that uncanny valley that they're going. It's just really awkward to look at. And then you also got the wolves. Like, the scene when Belle would leave the castle and then suddenly she's surrounded by wolves. My God, that looks fake. Like, I'm sorry. That is another thing that's just laughably bad. Like, I don't know what it is when this movie tries to make, like, these, like, threatening mammal-like creatures. It just looks terrible. I'm sorry. It looks laughably bad. And I don't know who provided the CGI in this, but it's just, yeah, it honestly sucks. But then, you do actually have some of the good things. Like, I'm not really just bashing this trailer altogether. There are some good things to be mentioned here. Especially when, like, the new clips that you have gotten, a lot of it is mostly some of the big moments in the movie. You got clips showing some of the big song numbers, like Gaston, where you could tell that there's going to be a lot of major choreography in there. And then you also got Be Our Guest, which, admittedly, other than Lumiere, or like Ewan McGregor Lumiere, it actually does look pretty nice, I gotta say. I'll give it to that, it's trying to be reminiscent of the colorful nature of the original animated feature when they would sing that big song. And then you also do get a little bit of a preview of the big dance number of Beauty and the Beast when you see Belle and Beast just dancing together in the big ballroom scene. And you can tell a little bit that they are trying to, like, no pun intended, to take some of the steps that the animated feature has taken, but the fact that it's going to be live action, yeah, it's not going to have as much of an impact as the original movie. I'm sorry. It's just like, I don't think it's going to be that much worth it right there. But going back into the good things, like, a lot of the actors that I did like when looking at the previous trailers, like, honestly, I can tell that they're actually doing pretty well. Like, we are seeing a little bit more of Dan Stevens as the Beast, and even though I just said that, yeah, he looks stupid, but at least Dan Stevens' job in his performance as the Beast, like, wow, this guy actually does a bit of justice to Robbie Benson. He actually does a pretty good job, to be honest. It actually, he actually can perform pretty well, and I do appreciate that. But then you also have Luke Evans as Gaston, where you do have a little bit of a clip of just him, he's pretty much just saying, like, oh, how beautiful you are, you look magnificent, and he's just talking to a mirror. Like, that is actually cute. Like, that I do have a feeling that, like, Luke Evans is actually going to do a pretty good job as Gaston, so that I might actually give him some points to it. But also at the same time, I mean, at least in terms of the backgrounds, like when you look at the sets, when you look at the area around Beast Castle or even in Belle's Village, it's actually really good. The area that they are in actually works out very well, and it looks very reminiscent to the original animated feature. So that actually does hold some promise. So yeah, overall, I would say with this trailer, we are getting a lot of the good and we are getting a lot of the bad. But, like, this is, like, massive mixed results. Like, I don't know how it's going to come out when the movie will be hitting theaters. Like, honestly, at this point, I don't know if I'm just going to come out, like, hating it as much as I would, like, with either Maleficent or, like, the Alice in Wonderland movies. Or maybe I would just come out, like, thinking it could be okay. Like, it's not going to be, like, this is no way going to be in the levels of the Jungle Book. But, like, maybe it could just come out as just okay with something like, either Pete's Dragon or even Cinderella. Where it's not, like, it wouldn't necessarily be bad, but it's never going to outshine the animated feature whatsoever. Like, this is just going to be a thing that exists, and after, like, just 2 months after it was released on Blu-ray and DVD, I don't think people are going to be talking about it. So, yeah, honestly, I don't know. For me, it's a bit of a mixed result, but at this point, we're not going to be getting any more trailers, or maybe we will get more, but they're just going to be on TV and stuff like that. Like, I don't know if they're going to be doing something for Super Bowl, but I don't know. I honestly don't care. I honestly don't even care about a Super Bowl. I'm not a football fan. I'm Canadian. I'm more into hockey. Yeah, I am more on that kind of stereotype right there. Nah, but anyways, going back into Beauty and the Beast, if you guys actually are excited and more optimistic about this movie, then all you have to do is just wait until this film gets into theaters on March 17th. Okay, so for our next story right here, I want to talk to you guys about someone who actually put in a massive impact in the animation industry, or at least one part of the animation industry, and I highly doubt that you guys don't really know his name, but he actually did play a huge factor when it comes to the Looney Tunes, believe it or not. Like, yeah, sure, he's no Chuck Jones, he's no Friz Freleng, but if it weren't for this guy, we would probably not be talking about the Looney Tunes today. Like, it wouldn't be as popular as it is now. And this guy actually did help maintain the Looney Tunes popularity, even during its darkest time. And I am talking, of course, about Hal Gear, who unfortunately passed away this week, but I can definitely confirm to you that he absolutely lived a full life, considering that he died at the age of 100. So the dude actually did manage to go through an entire century of his life. Now, allow me to tell you a little bit about this guy's story about his life and what he has done in the animation industry. So for starters, back in his very beginnings, he was actually in the military. He was actually a combat cameraman. I'm using my source here, like I'm actually reading through Wikipedia, which is sourced. It actually does have a bit of confirmed information. So it says, prior to his career in the entertainment industry, Gear served as a combat cameraman with the 16th Combat Camera Unit, enlisting just 2 weeks after the Pearl Harbor attack. As a sergeant, he participated in several major projects, including film documentary China Crisis, received a field commission to lieutenant, and took part in 86 combat missions during World War II. He remained in the Army Reserve for 24 years, achieving the ranks of major. But after the war, it was somewhere along the lines after the late 40s or something like that, that he decided to just drop the Army and decided, well, not drop the Army, but decided to move his career onto the entertainment industry. And he actually did work at Disney between 1950 and 1955, which is why you will find different news sources that actually state that he actually did work on Disney films like Peter Pan. But then, afterwards, after his little short time at Disney in the special effects department, he decided to go and work at several independent production companies that are not necessarily listed, but it wouldn't be until 1967 that he decided to go to Warner Brothers and work on the Looney Tunes. But considering that I am talking about the late 60s during that time, that is pretty much the end of the golden era for Looney Tunes, or at least the era when they were pretty much just making cartoon after cartoon after cartoon, when it was pretty much over in 1969. However, Hal decided to stay with Warner Brothers and to continue the legacy of the Looney Tunes. What ended up happening was that he stayed in order to work on the Bugs Bunny show, which, if you don't know, the Bugs Bunny show was pretty much the long-running TV series that ran for probably 4 decades that just showed nothing but Looney Tunes cartoons from 1948 all the way up to 1964 or 1965, I believe. Like up to the end of the golden era. But it was pretty much just showing all of that, and he pretty much stayed for the Bugs Bunny show, and he eventually climbed up the ranks to be a co-producer. But then, when the 80s would come in, he would be working again at Warner Brothers, like now with a brand new re-established animation studio, where he was one of the big heads, and he was pretty much working with Friz Freleng in order to maintain the popularity of the Looney Tunes cartoons. And they would end up working on several TV specials and even some movies, including the Looney 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 Bugs Bunny movie, and also Bugs Bunny's third movie, 1001 Rabbit Tales, where he even actually got an Emmy Award, believe it or not. But also, one of his biggest contributions as well was that he was the big man in charge in order to go and get Bugs Bunny his own Hollywood Walk of Fame, which didn't happen until 1985, where Bugs was actually the second cartoon character after Mickey Mouse in order to go and actually claim a Hollywood Walk of Fame. So yeah, that's basically the whole story with Hal Geary. It wouldn't be until 1987 when Hal decided to just retire and just live his own life. But yeah, like, I think the biggest thing with Hal Geary is that this is the man who we should thank for having the Looney Tunes still be relevant to this day, because after the Looney Tunes could no longer make any sort of cartoons, they were pretty much, they were pretty much entering a dark time because, like, okay, the Looney Tunes are no longer relevant. They can no longer make any more cartoons, so they're kind of on a stump. But at least we got Hal Geary, who decided that their reputation and their legacy should still continue to grow. So he helped with the Bugs Bunny show in order to really make that big. And then he would join Friz Freleng in order to make some new stuff that would be the Looney Tunes. It would be Looney Tunes related during the 80s, like the Looney 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 Bugs Bunny movie and Bugs Bunny's third movie, 1001 Rabbit Tales. So he's pretty much nurturing the Looney Tunes, and it wouldn't be until after he retired. What ended up happening is that the Looney Tunes actually did find brand new popularity again, where during that time, there would be brand new animated shorts of the Looney Tunes that would come out. And then on television, there would be the Tiny Toons Adventures and Animaniacs that would come in, and eventually they would have some cameos all over again. And then in 1996, their popularity got a massive boost when Space Jam was released. So at that point, what Hal Geary did was just made sure that the Looney Tunes would at least stay relevant during the 80s and during the 70s. Like, after, like, they would no longer make cartoons. That, like, Hal Geary just pretty much gave them a path to go and be relevant, to be timeless, for people to remember who the Looney Tunes are. Like, I think without him, like, honestly, it would only be animation geeks who would know who the Looney Tunes are. Like, cartoons that we know and love nowadays, like Duck Amuck or What's Opera Doc or Canary Row or Birds Anonymous or any of those cartoons, they would not be relevant to this day if it weren't for Hal Geary, that still that made sure that the Looney Tunes just don't die out in obscurity and they're just cartoons of the olden days, you know, not ending up having a reputation like Woody Woodpecker or even Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. You know, to give them a purpose, to give them life, to show that the Looney Tunes can still have something to offer, even if it's not cartoons, even if it's just in the form of TV specials, even if it's in the form of, like, compilation movies. You know, they, like, it still needs to grow in. Now, I'm not saying that Hal Geary was the only one. Like, of course, there is Friz Freleng, there is also Chuck Jones, and there are many other people. But what I'm saying is that Hal Geary was a key player in order to keep the Looney Tunes alive. And I think that's the biggest thing about him. And honestly, just as a military major and also playing a big part in the animation industry, all I could say is just, Hal Geary, I just want to thank you for your service, for what you did for your country, and also for your service for what you did in animation. Okay, so for our next story right here, we actually got a pretty weird idea, and I'm actually pretty surprised that out of all people, Entertainment Weekly, that actually decided to go and report this. Like, honestly, I would just go and fish something like this out on something like Anime News Network, but no, I guess this news would probably be big enough to mention here. And what I'm talking about is Ruby. Now, you guys probably may know Ruby as one of Rooster Teeth's biggest web series that they have going on. It's fully animated, just like another of their big show, like another big series that they have, Red vs. Blue, but this one is entirely anime-based, and I actually remember last year I went and did a review of Ruby. Like, I pretty much watched all of Volume 1 through 3, and I gotta say, I was actually pretty impressed. Like, sure, the animation is not, like, it's not big budgeted in order to have, like, massively clear animation, but still, like, the writing is still absolutely top-notch, and you still do get, like, memorable characters that are very well thought out and really complex. But it seems that, apparently, the co-founder of Rooster Teeth, Bernie Burns, actually thought up of a crazy idea about what he might want to do. And apparently, going back into my source here on Entertainment Weekly, his idea is, I really think Ruby is something that could be a live-action movie someday. We have to go through all the comic book movies, and then we have to go through the video game phase, which I really believe is next. All the video game franchises will be like Marvel movies are now. We'll see how long that lasts, and we'll see if there's room for something like Ruby in there. I would like to see that. So yeah, basically, he is pretty much thinking at this point that one day we could have a live-action movie based on Ruby. However, I just want to point out right now that there is no rush on making it. Nothing is happening right now in terms of the situation. Like, they're not immediately going into production for it. They're not looking for a cast or nothing like that. He also stated that right now we're looking into... right now we're looking at other properties based on Ruby. We have got the video games. We have Ruby Chibi. I think there's opportunity for a spin-off show. There's so many characters, the audience for that is just going nuts. We keep reevaluating the upper limits of what the franchise can do all the time. At this point, we're just putting out all the stops and moving ahead with it as fast as we can. So basically, what he's pretty much saying is that right now, there's currently no big rush in order to make a Ruby movie. Nothing is really confirmed. It's just an idea that Bernie Burns actually has. And for now, like, he's just focusing on just working on Ruby as a franchise, considering that he did announce that this year in the fall, we will be getting the fifth volume of Ruby. So, honestly, like, I can imagine that you could turn something like Ruby into a live-action movie, but for something like with what Ruby pretty much established, you need a big budget. Like, this isn't something like what Rooster Teeth is developing themselves, rather it be like with the series or even with Laser Team. Like, you need a legitimately big budget in order to actually do justice if you want to do a big live-action reboot of Ruby. And honestly, something like that shouldn't necessarily be too hard. Like, you don't have any random CGI monstrosities. Like technically they would with all the different creatures that they have in there, but, like, they're like, monstrosities on purpose. It's not like in, for example, like, the recent Power Rangers reboot and that, like, little robot guy that apparently everybody's freaking out about because it just looks like a little piece of CGI monstrosity right there. going back to Ruby, like, I can imagine that eventually it would have to be a big budget. But I honestly don't know at this point, unless there's a big studio out there like Lionsgate or Sony or Paramount or Universal, like, they really would like to have a Ruby movie going out, like, to actually come out into fruition. Like, I don't know. It would probably, like, if this ever happens, we would probably need a lot of time. Like, I don't think we would even see it during the 2020 decade, to be honest. Like, it would probably take a while. But also, I just want to make a little comment regarding something that he did state. And that is honestly how Bernie Burns sees with the phase that we are going with movies. Like, okay, yeah, sure. Right now we're in the superhero phase, considering some of the biggest films in recent years is pretty much Marvel movies, like Captain America Civil War, the Avengers, the Iron Man movies, and I'm sure one of the biggest movies this year is going to be Spider-Man Homecoming. But then, the next phase is going to be video games? That I'm honestly unsure of. I don't know. Like, I'm not going to deny that eventually we will see a time when video game movies are going to be really big and they're going to be really popular. But with the way that they're going, it's really hard to imagine. Because if you look into 2016, we got movies like Ratchet & Clank, Warcraft, and Assassin's Creed. And those movies didn't necessarily go well. So, I don't know, it's going to take a while if we really are going to go into a video game phase. So, honestly, like, we'll probably have to be patient. And if it's true what he's saying that, like, we have to wait a little bit after the video game phase, like I said, I think the longest time that we could possibly wait after this would have to be maybe after the 2020 decade. I don't know, it's going to take a while, but honestly, the idea of a live-action Ruby movie, it doesn't sound impossible. Like, I can totally imagine it could probably happen if there would be a big studio that would actually be willing to do it. But who knows? Maybe it could be a good idea. Maybe it will not. Let's just wait and see what time says. And so, finally, we now have Matt's Pick of the Week. And for this week, I know I might be a little bit late to the party, but I still think that it's rather important to mention. Now, luckily, with the way that 2017 is going, we don't really have a lot of bad news that's not associated with Trump's tyranny. Like, that's one good thing to mention, is that at least the bad news outside of politics is rather minimal. And I understand that in 2016, one of the biggest disasters that occurred is mostly the deaths of many different celebrities. And, like, there are definitely a lot of big name ones that unfortunately had to leave us, like David Bowie, there's Prince, there's Carrie Fisher. And I think the one that I'm going to miss the most is going to be Gene Wilder. But with that said, I can definitely imagine that in 2017, we're definitely not going to be getting as much celebrity deaths as last year. But it's still not going to change that there will be celebrities who will pass away, sadly. And even in the month of January, we do have a couple of examples. Like, the major big profile ones that really hit social media include Mary Tyler Moore, and the one that I will miss the most, at least so far this year, is John Hurt. Now, if you guys haven't heard the news, it was on late Friday, I believe, the 27th of January, that sadly, John Hurt passed away of pancreatic cancer, and he was at the age of 77. Now, it could be very debatable regarding if it would be considered young or if he would live a full age. It's kind of in that weird middle. Honestly, I just feel like, yeah, he definitely went out as an old man, but I do feel like he still has a few years going for him. Like, if it weren't for that pancreatic cancer, like, he would still live on probably until, I don't know, maybe like somewhere in his 80s or something like that. But the one big thing that I do want to say about John Hurt is that he's one of the very few actors that I could think of that you could pretty much put him in the category of a master actor. Like, no matter what, you could put him either on the stage or on the screen, on television or in the movies, and he can give you the performance of a lifetime, especially with how he did receive 2 Oscar nominations, one for Best Supporting Actor for Midnight Express, and then also for Best Actor in The Elephant Man. But considering that this is the animation podcast, I want to talk to you guys a little bit about his contribution into animation, because John Hurt really does have a distinctive voice that is absolutely powerful enough to bring out some fantastic characters. And I'm using my source here in The Hollywood Reporter, who actually provided a really good list of many of the feature films and projects that he has worked on to bring amazing characters to life. And yeah, he has done a few animated projects as well. He did the Tigger movie, he did Thumbelina, but I want to tell you guys about 3 performances that really did stood out in animation. The first of which I want to mention is, this is his great example of being a brave and courageous hero. Like, this is the leader that you need. And I am talking, of course, about his performance as Aragorn in the 1978 Ralph Bakshi animated adaptation of The Lord of the Rings. And this could be a little bit debatable, honestly, but John Hurt's performance there is probably one of the few things that movie actually did a lot better than the Peter Jackson film. Because Aragorn here, my God, you could definitely tell that he is such a memorably brave character, like, absolutely strong, and someone that you don't want to be on his bad side. Like, you could tell that as long as you're cool with him, like, he will definitely help you out. Like, he could tell that people, like, the hobbits, like Frodo and Sam and all those people, they're definitely one of those that, like, he sees them and he knows to trust them because he knows his instincts. It just says that these are good people. You know, they know Gandalf. And I remember one of the most memorable lines that he has done, it was actually showing his nobility in a way, because and also not just his nobility, but like, he could be a threat to his opponents. When Frodo was questioning his loyalty about, like, the ring, and John Hurt basically replied with, "If I wanted the ring, then I would have it now." It's so good. Like, it's definitely fantastic. Now, the second example that I want to bring in, surprisingly enough, from the same year, and he actually does play another hero character. This time, however, it is not necessarily like a brave, courageous, and strong hero, but this is a cunning hero. Someone that's more brain than brawn. And I'm talking, of course, about Watership Down, where John Hurt actually played as Hazel. And in there, you could tell that Hazel is someone that's that has more of a heart and the will to go and survive and, you know, to pretty much, like, go far and wide for the sake of his people or his rabbits, per se. Like, he started out trying to go and find a perfect sanctuary for them. And then there would be the second mission, which is to bring in some dough so that they could have children. So it can ultimately be a rabbit sanctuary where they don't have to fear for any predators or the destruction of man. And like, you can definitely tell that Hazel is someone you can immediately trust, because he was pretty much the first one that sees how his little brother is, like, so paranoid that trouble is pretty much happening. And even though everybody was just making fun of him, like, "Ah, shut up, you freaking lunatic," like, Hazel was actually the first one to look at him, to look at his brother and just say, "You know what? he might have a point. Maybe there is some trouble brewing that's going to be going on. We should probably get out of here and go in a better sanctuary. Who knows? And it's honestly like true admiration that you would have for a character like Hazel. And there are times when like he could be stuck in a sticky situation, but he knows for which allies he wanted to go and make like in order to help him out in his little adventure that he would have. And by the way, there is actually a fun little fact that I do have for you guys, which is very coincidental, is that, funny enough, where John Hurt would play as Hazel in the animated feature of Watership Down, a few decades later, in the animated series from 1999 of Watership Down, John Hurt would actually return, but he would play as the villain, General Woundwort. Which is actually kind of funny, where you would have the exact same story, and the actor would end up playing both the hero, and then later he would be the villain. In a way, I guess you could say it's kind of like that old saying in The Dark Knight. It's either you die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself as the villain. And that's pretty much what happened with John Hurt's relationship with Watership Down. And speaking of villains, however, there is actually one more animated project that he did work on, in which his performance is just absolutely amazing, and where he can really play a believable and admirable hero, he can also play such a threatening and menacing villain. And I think like one of his best villain roles has to hands down be the Horn King in Disney's The Black Cauldron. Now, let me just start this off by saying, say what you will about The Black Cauldron. Like, I know it's no Chicken Little and Home on the Range, but yeah, like, I think a lot of us can agree that it is one of the weaker Disney films, especially when the main characters are not really all that interesting and the journey itself is not as engaging as many of Disney's other films. But the one thing that absolutely makes it worth it to watch, and the best thing to ever come out of The Black Cauldron, has to be the Horn King. And a lot of it has to do with John Hurt's performance. Like, you could tell that he has this, like, dark nature in him. Like, you know, this is a guy who will literally unleash hell. And, like, I'm not gonna lie, the Horn King is hands down the most underrated Disney villain ever created, because the threatening level that he has is almost on the same page as, like, Maleficent and Chernabog. Like, he really does have such power. And you could tell, like, I remember there's this one scene where, like, you got this entire group of thugs, like, they're just, you know, like, partying and celebrating how evil they are. It's almost like a scene from the Pirates in the Caribbean ride. And then suddenly the Horn King comes in. Everything stops. Like, he is just right there. Like, holy crap. Don't, like, you cannot say anything bad. You cannot, like, misbehave or anything in front of him, or else you're pretty much dead. He has total power, and it's someone you should not screw with. And I'm telling you, it's such, like, what John Hurt performed in there, it's phenomenal. It's such an amazing job. But I just want to say right now that John Hurt's performance doesn't go outside, well, it doesn't go just in animation. Like, I cannot just talk about his animation performances. Like, I also have to highlight many of his live-action roles as well, considering that he did appear in many big-name movies. I've already mentioned his Oscar-nominated performances in The Midnight Express and also The Elephant Man, but he was also Kane, where he was the first person to pretty much get an alien come out of his chest, which, funny enough, he actually reprised his role in Spaceballs, where, like, you just see him at the desk, and then suddenly the chest buster is about to come out, and he's just there. Oh no, not again. Such a great performance. Like, you could tell that John Hurt would be a great sport. But also at the same time, he also appeared in other amazing big name films. He was Mr. Ollivander in the Harry Potter movies, including Sword of the Stone and Deathly Hallows Part 1 and 2. He was also the evil fascist leader Adam Salter in V for Vendetta. Another great example of a villain role where, like, you could tell he has total power, he is absolutely threatening, and you cannot screw up when you're in front of his presence. Like, definitely a powerful villain right there, almost as much as the Horned King, I would say. He was also in Indiana Jones and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull as Professor Oxley. And also, he was Trevor Broom Bruderholm in the Hellboy movies, in Hellboy, Hellboy 2, and also in the 2007 animated TV movie Hellboy Blood and Iron. And I just have to say, like I said in the very beginning, my God, John Hurt is just a phenomenal actor. And every single performance that he has done is just, you know, it really makes it such a standout performance. Rather it be, like, he could take just a mediocre movie like The Black Cauldron and just elevate it to a new level by bringing up such an unforgettable character like the Horned King. Or, like, he would even add into something special, like with the Hellboy movies or the Harry Potter films, or even, like, be, like, the most memorable thing in movies like Alien. And keep in mind, like, Alien is such a very well-known and popular movie, so, like, it does really say something when John Hurt would step into the scene and he would, like, just steal the show entirely. So I'm definitely going to miss him, and I'll definitely miss his wonderful performance that he has been giving for so long in numerous of different different places. And also, I just want to mention quickly, I just found it in front of me, but I did mention a lot of his movie roles, but he also did a lot of great TV roles as well, where he was the storyteller in Jim Henson's The Storyteller. He was also in the Alan Clark Diaries, The Confessions, and also Merlin. But at the same time, he was known to be the War Doctor in the 2013-2014 series of Doctor Who. So yeah, going back to what I was saying, like, hands down, John Hurt is just a legendary actor who can take on any role and he'll give you such a magnificent performance. And I highly do encourage you guys to go and you can pretty much share your thoughts and tell me, what was the performance that you feel like John Hurt impacted you the most? Like, what would be the most memorable role for you that John Hurt played? Because I'm sure everybody has, like, one or a couple of performances that John Hurt definitely brought out. But for me, like, there are many of them, not just for animated films, but also for many other live action projects like V for Vendetta and Hellboy and Alien and so much more. So I'm definitely going to miss the guy, and may John Hurt rest in peace. And that is all that I got for this week. So thank you guys so much for watching, for listening to this episode of the Animation Podcast. You can find more of my work at film-book.com. All you have to do is search for Mathieu Brunet or the Animation Podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Animat505. If you have listened to this podcast on iTunes or any other podcast service, do you mind doing us a little favor and rate and review this episode? That would be wonderful. And if you are listening to this podcast on YouTube, then hit that little like button on our video and leave us a little comment on your thoughts on the news this week. Tune in next week for the latest episode of the Animation Podcast and all things animation. Thank you guys so much for listening, and until next week, see you later, dudes!